The 2004 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 352, The Secrets of NIMS. When the Book of Mormon was dictated, were there others in it? A paper presented by David Anderson.
Extraordinarily bright and has a lot of insight to offer into this particular discussion in Book of Mormon studies. So on that note of flattery, I'll go ahead and turn the time over to David.
Thanks, Brent. Brent didn't tell you, but you can probably see. It's obvious I taught him all that he knows about bodybuilding. I'm going to mostly read from my paper, and at times I'm going to leave the text and make comments. And I'll need to omit certain parts of the paper because of its length, but I'm hopeful that with the introduction I'm explaining things in enough detail that those of you who have been thinking about these kinds of issues for some time won't be completely bored, and those of you for whom this is newer will be able to follow where I'm going. Readers of the Book of Mormon today are consigned to live in interesting times. Inquiry and discussion about the book's historical claims has accelerated in the last few decades, becoming more complex and interesting. The Mesoamerican Others hypothesis, that is the principal focus of this paper, has emerged within the context of other related ideas and theories about the book as a historical narrative. By way of background, I'll summarize that context and explain how the hypothesis is related to prior understandings of the relationship between the people within the book's narrative and the ancient Amerindians whose ancestors migrated from Asia. Since its first appearance, readers of the book have developed theories about the location of the events and the identity of the populations it describes. Under what has come to be known as the limited geography theory, the principal events narrated in the book took place not throughout the Americas, as most early readers had thought, but in a relatively small area located in southern Mexico and Guatemala, known as Mesoamerica. This theory about the location of the Book of Mormon events was articulated by John Sorensen in his 1984 Ensign articles and in his 1985 An Ancient American Setting for the Book of Mormon. While that answer to the location question has not been officially endorsed by the Church and is not without its difficulties and informed critics, it is accepted by many as the most plausible current hypothesis. I assume a Mesoamerican location for purposes of this discussion. The issues addressed here, while sometimes referred to generically as part of the limited geography theory, are only incidentally connected to the location and spatial scope of the book's narrative. Rather, they are concerned with the identity and origin of the populations the Book of Mormon describes and their relationship to the Native Americans later encountered by the Europeans. Initially, readers understood the people in the book to be comprised only of immigrants from the Near East and their descendants, and believed that those peoples were ancestors of all the pre-Columbian inhabitants of the Americas. In the 20th century, however, as awareness of archaeological evidence about the early setting of the Americas by Asians emerged, certain LDS readers began to recognize that the Book of Mormon might not be and need not be interpreted as an account of the origins of all pre-Columbian peoples, but only a subset of such inhabitants. Yet even readers who acknowledged the existence of other peoples in the Americas did not imagine that they were actually referred to and described in the text. Their recognition, rather, was only that the Book of Mormon story did not preclude the existence of such others. In a seminal article published in 1992 in the Journal of Book of Mormon Studies, John Sorensen announced that everyone had gotten it quite wrong. In answer to the question put in the article's title, "When Lehi's party arrived in the land, did they find others there?" Sorensen argues the Lehite immigrant party did, and indeed must have, if the events the book narrates are to be understood as history. From the very beginning, the Lehites may have multiplied exceedingly, but they could only have done so in the way the text describes, Sorensen argues, by encountering and assimilating indigenous Amerindians. Sorensen's article thus marks the most recent change in the understanding of the relationship between the Book of Mormon peoples and the others of Asian origin that preceded them in settling the continent. That changed understanding, which occurred in four stages, deserves further elaboration. Each stage is based upon a set of assumptions and inferences about past events in the Americas. The slide as I'm going through this is just a summary of the stages that I'm describing now in the text. In the first stage, each stage is based upon a set of assumptions and inferences about past events in the Americas, that is, what actually happened, and also about what the book is saying as an ancient record. In the first stage, no ancient Amerindian others were believed to exist in the Americas. Hence, because the Nephites and Lamanites were all the descendants of Israelite immigrants, all modern Amerindians were those the book's numerous forward-looking passages refer to as the remnant of the house of Israel and as the children of Lehi. For persons interpreting the book at stage one, all Native Americans clearly were members of this modern remnant because there was no one else from whom they could be descended. In the second stage, ancient others are understood to exist in the Americas, but still are not referred to in the Book of Mormon narrative. They may have later encountered and mixed with the Lamanites in the centuries between Moroni and Joseph Smith, but they do not function as actors in the text. At the second stage, the origin and identity of the peoples in the narrative thus remains the same, but those of the book's modern remnant of the House of Israel becomes ambiguous. Because of the large number of other indigenous peoples, there is no way to know how or whether a modern Amerindian is related by lineage or by the culture of his or her ancestors to the Book of Mormon peoples who were alive at the end of the Nephite record. That's what occurs at stage two. At stage three, unnamed others enter the narrative for the first time, but only on the Lamanite side of things. The Nephites continue to be understood as Israelites and their descendants, while the term Lamanite very early on is used by Nephite record keepers to refer to the mixture of Laman's Israelites with indigenous Amerindian others. This third stage position wasn't formally articulated until the 1980s in Sorensen's Ancient American Setting book and in his Ensign articles. Okay. What I want to underline is that for 150 years, we were at stage one and then stage two. Matthew Roper, in his recent article, Nephi's Neighbors, has chronicled this shift from stage one to stage two. He doesn't refer to them that way, but he acknowledges that it was not until the 1980s that we start moving into stage three and stage four. Finally, at the fourth stage, Amerindian others are understood to be present in the narrative on both the Nephite and Lamanite side of things. Sorensen's 1993 article marks the movement from the third to the fourth stage. In the third and fourth stages, then, the actual origin and identity of the people acting inside the text becomes ambiguous, became ambiguous when readers abandoned the first stage. The actual origin and identity of the people acting inside the text becomes ambiguous, just as that of the book's modern era remnant of the House of Israel became ambiguous when readers abandoned the first stage and moved to the second. The cause of this increase in ambiguity, I believe, is the diminishing of the Book of Mormon's explanatory scope as a historical record. At stage one, that explanatory scope was so broad that no ancient American inhabitants were thought to exist outside the scope of the book's narrative. The book was understood as a record of the ancestors of all modern-era Amerindians. At stage four, in a fascinating reversal, these once non-existent ancient Americans rise from the archaeological dirt to enter the book's narrative and rescue it from incoherence. What recognition might they deserve in return for that saving act of service? What hath John wrought? In the following critical discussion, I'll focus on what I believe are serious textual problems that result from applying to the Book of Mormon the stage four understanding of the others' hypothesis articulated in Sorensen's 1993 article. Unless otherwise indicated, when I refer to the other's hypothesis, I mean that stage four historical situation and interpretive perspective. These difficulties include Nephi's and Jacob's silence or reticence about the Amerindian others, together with the statements and language which indicate they are writing as if all the actors in the text are descendants of immigrants from Jerusalem. I will then explain how the hypothesis is at odds with the book's portrayal of Lamanite identity and ideology, and its account of skin color distinctions between Nephites and Lamanites. Finally, after noting some language issues, I'll offer some further observations about the changing relationship between the peoples of the Book of Mormon and the indigenous others. Difficulty number one. If the others' hypothesis is correct, why does the Book of Mormon fail to mention the crucial events that made Nephite society possible? In Nephi's narrative, we are given a fairly consistent account of who is in the immigrant party whose journey to the land of promise he records. We can name and count them with some precision. After Lehi's prophecies and blessings, the small party splits. As the same family animosities acted out in Jerusalem, Arabia and aboard ship surface again, this time decisively and irreparably. The source of the tension again is that Laman and Lemuel accuse Nephi, their younger brother, of trying to rule over them. Thereafter, beginning at 2 Nephi chapter 5, a dramatic but unacknowledged jump in the narrative occurs. That leap is between the story of a small family group and the sudden appearance of a full-blown society. In order for the rest of the story of Nephite civilization to unfold, of course, such a narrative transition from family to society has to occur. The problem is that the situation described in chapter 5 cannot have occurred without an infusion of a large number of unmentioned native inhabitants. What are the characteristics of these native inhabitants? They aren't expressly mentioned in the narrative, but they have two significant features as actors in the story. They are necessary, and their existence must be inferred. Note that these two characteristics are the same no matter where the Book of Mormon narrative is thought of as occurring. Whether that location is in Mesoamerica, North America, or even the Malay Peninsula, the existence of such indigenous inhabitants is both necessary and yet must be inferred. Given the Mesoamerican location we are assuming, these necessary inferred actors would be Mayans, or, given the time frame of 2 Nephi, predecessors of the Mayans. Since the text itself doesn't name them, I'll call them necessary inferred Mayans, or NIMs for short. If someone prefers to refer to them instead as Mayan predecessors, or more generically as just Amerindians, nothing in the difficulties presented by the early narrative turns on the name. Again, the NIMs are necessary because without them it would have been physically impossible for Nephi's group to have accomplished in his lifetime the things he describes. Consider what Nephi's people are described as doing and accomplishing within 20 years of the Lehite arrival date. They were tilling the earth, planting seeds and reaping in abundance, raising flocks and herds and animals of every kind, building buildings, working in all manner of wood, working in all manner of iron, steel, copper, brass, gold, and silver. The only public building mentioned is the temple. Its dimensions are not given, but the manner of, the manner of construction was like unto the Temple of Solomon, and the workmanship thereof was exceedingly fine. It's from 2 Nephi 5. Along with these reported activities and accomplishments, of course, the community would have had to prepare food, make pottery and clothing, tend to children, and perform other domestic tasks and community activities. Further, by the 30-year mark, Nephi reports that the group had also participated in wars with the Lamanite group. Without augmentation by indigenous peoples, those I'm calling the Nims, the narrative indicates that at the time the family split, there would have been on Nephi's side only three adult males, Nephi, Sam, and Zoram, or five if we include Nephi's younger brothers, Jacob and Joseph. In his Others article, Sorensen says that he, quote, generously estimates, close quote, at the time of the split, that in Nephi's group there could have been as many as 11 adults and 13 children for a total of 24. Sorensen notes that even if what he characterizes as a phenomenal population growth rate of 0.7% per year were assumed, it would have taken 100 years for the size of the group to double to 48. Using the same growth rate at about 30 years after arrival, Nephi's group would have numbered only about 30. In a more lengthy analysis of Book of Mormon population sizes later published in the Farms Review of Books, James Smith concluded that the most likely estimated population size for the Nephite group at about 35 years after arrival would be between 25 and 35 people. It thus appears reasonable to estimate that 30 years after their arrival, Nephi's Israelite group would have likely consisted only of about 30 men, women, and children. Such a small group plainly could not have accomplished the things Nephi reports. 10 or 12 adult, able-bodied men could not work in agriculture, mine, refine, and work in numerous metals, construct and maintain dwellings, engage in animal husbandry, and construct a sizable public building while preparing for and fighting with what the text calls wars with the Lamanite group. Moreover, for Nephi to report that he had become king over such a tiny village group would indicate either megalomania or an ironic sense of humor not otherwise displayed in his writings. In short, the impossibility of the narrative, given the small number of Israelites, is what makes those I'm calling the NIMS live up to the first two letters of their acronym. They are plainly necessary for the narrative to make sense, and their existence must be inferred. Given the list of tasks and accomplishments the Nephite community is described as performing and achieving, how many NIMS would have had to join with this group of Israelites in order for Nephi's narrative to make sense? Obviously, any estimate will be based on some interpretation of the actual size of the activities and accomplishments reported at 2 Nephi 5. Because Nephi reports that his people built a temple likened to Solomon's without suggesting that its physical dimensions were any smaller, an estimate of thousands of NIMS might not be unreasonable. However, we need not decide what the most reasonable estimate of the population size might be. A more useful inquiry for present purposes is this. If it would be impossible for a community of 30 to accomplish what the narrative describes, how many multiples of 30 are necessary at a minimum for the narrative to become plausible? In other words, what is a reasonable floor or lower limit on the community size? Based upon the text at 2 Nephi 5, particularly considered in light of what Jacob later reports, I believe that a community of 300 people can effectively serve as that floor. Such a community would have about 150 males, with a still smaller number of able-bodied male workers. It would likely take many dozens of such workers just to mine, refine, and work in the six different types of metals which Nephi reports he taught his people to use. In addition to animal husbandry and agricultural activities, dwelling construction and maintenance, and defense activities, there would also need to be considerable excess labor available for the construction of the temple and other non-residential buildings. That this is an unreasonably low estimate also is supported by the type of advanced social situation described by Nephi's younger brother Jacob, which includes accumulation of personal wealth, together with class distinctions based upon such things as costly apparel, citing to Jacob 2. Such a situation would require further labor specialization, as well as other persons occupied with barter and exchange with surrounding communities. With that background, then, let's turn to the question about why Nephi doesn't mention the NIMS. Whatever the ratio of Israelites to NIMS, we conclude is required by the narrative, an infusion of a substantially larger group of NIMS is necessary in order for the type of social accomplishments and functions reported by Nephi and Jacob to become possible. In light of the crucial role played by the NIMS in the founding of Nephite society, why does Nephi nevertheless not mention them? Clearly, any answer to that question must consider what Nephi had to have done and experienced under the other's hypothesis, as well as the type of information he judged worthy to include in his narrative. With respect to the latter, in my view, the best evidence of the type of information and the level of detail Nephi actually judged worthy to include in his account is what he actually did include. Nephi had to have encountered the NIMS soon after his family's arrival in the New World, yet he did not begin writing his small plates account, he tells us, until approximately 20 years after the arrival. Accordingly, from the moment Nephi began inscribing what he called his small plates, or actually Jacob calls them the small plates, he already knew about the NIMS. He had already encountered them, and they had merged with his people. For Nephi, however, the NIMS would not have been a mere placeholding acronym. They were actual people with alien dress, customs, religion, and a new material culture adapted to the land they inhabited. In order for the narrative to make sense, as we have seen, Nephi had to have done the following things with the NIMS: learned to communicate with them by learning their language and or teaching them his, taught and converted them to the pre-Advent form of Christianity he had received by revelation, which included persuading them for the present to follow the law of Moses, persuaded them to help him, along with his four brothers in Zoram, to build the New World Temple. Since Jacob tells us Nephi wielded the sword of Laban in defense of his people, Nephi also must have fought beside them in common defense of their homes and families. Having done and experienced all these things with the NIMS, knowing their names and experiencing their friendship and devotion, Nephi nevertheless says nothing about them. Instead, he begins by describing his people as entirely self-sufficient. Looking back on their arrival from the time he began working on his small plates, Nephi reports what the immigrant group did and what they encountered. We did begin to till the earth and began to plant seeds. Yea, we did put all our seeds into the earth, which we had brought from the land of Jerusalem. And it came to pass that they did grow exceedingly, wherefore we were blessed in abundance. In his other's article, Sorensen imagines what he calls an unacknowledged Thanksgiving story, in which the Amerindians would have shared indigenous foods and agricultural know-how with the Israelite immigrants, introducing them, for example, to maize. According to Nephi's retrospective narrative, however, the Lehites initially went about planting their old world crops without any assistance from native peoples or seeds. To be sure, the encounter with the Nims might have occurred later, but the point is that looking back, Nephi takes the time to include a description of his family's first agricultural efforts, including an explanation of where the seeds they planted came from. He mentions the seeds his family brought along, but not the New World seeds provided by the Nims. Filling in more detail about what the Lehites found upon their arrival, Nephi further reports, "We did find upon the land of promise, as we journeyed in the wilderness, that there were beasts in the forests of every kind, both the cow and the ox, and the ass and the horse, and the goat and the wild goat, and all manner of wild animals, which were for the use of men. And we did find all manner of ore, both of gold and of silver and of copper." As Nephi looks back on what he and his family encountered, why would he focus on animals and ores rather than people? Nephi did not converse with the animals, and unlike his relationship with the Nims, he did not learn their language, learn to recognize their strange-sounding personal names, nor become their teacher, protector, and friend. Yet he takes the time to enumerate the encountered animals. In numerous other places in the small plates, Nephi similarly provides detail about what his family encountered. Given this level of narrative and explanatory detail in the small plates, it is reasonable to expect that if Nephi had indeed encountered new alien peoples whom he converted, he would have mentioned the event. Nephi's failure to mention the Nims is inconsistent with the themes of his narrative, and I'm going to those themes include repeatedly Nephi's illustration from his own life of himself and others being blessed for their faith, having faith in God. I'm going to omit reading that section and move to the next section. Do Nephi's statements about the nature or purpose of the small plates explain his silence or reticence about the Nims? It has been argued that a reason Nephi may not have mentioned the indigenous others is the limited nature and purpose of his small plates narrative. In other words, if this portion of the Book of Mormon were a full history, like Nephi's other plates, the Nims might have been mentioned. A recent article by John Sorensen and Matthew Roper thus suggests, if we had the plates of Nephi that reported the more historical part of the Lehite story, perhaps we would find on them explicit information about such contacts with resident populations. This implied explanation for Nephi's silence does not fare well under scrutiny. Rather, if we consider Nephi's repeated characterizations of the nature and purpose of his account on the small plates, they make his silence about the indigenous others even more difficult to explain. Beginning his retrospective narrative, Nephi introduces himself as a person who, along with suffering afflictions, has had a great knowledge of the goodness and mysteries of God. Therefore, I make a record of my proceedings in my days. When he begins his narrative again, after summarizing his father's record, at 1 Nephi 10, he states that he proceeds, quote, to give an account of my proceedings and my reign and ministry, end quote. That this is not just a passing comment is indicated by the subheading provided by Nephi for his first book, which announces that its subject will be his reign and ministry. At the end of the previous chapter, where he first announces he is making two sets of plates, Nephi explains, nevertheless, I have received a commandment of the Lord that I should make these plates for the special purpose that there should be an account engraven of the ministry of my people. Upon the other plates should be engraven an account of the reign of the kings and the wars and contentions of my people. Wherefore, these plates are for the more part of the ministry, and the other plates are for the more part of the reign of the kings and the wars and the contentions of my people. And after I had made these plates by way of commandment, I, Nephi, received a commandment that the ministry and the prophecies, the more plain and precious parts of them, should be written upon these plates, and that the things which were written should be kept for the instruction of my people, who should possess the land, and also for otherwise purposes, which purposes are known unto the Lord. As noted above, encountering and, despite their alien language and culture, converting the numerous Nims would surely have been the most significant event in Nephi's ministry. It alone led to his becoming a king, for it is only through the Nims that Nephi can change from family patriarch to the ruler of a society. Yet even though he describes that the purpose of his account is to record his ministry and reign, he fails to mention what would have been the most important event in each. In addition, the argument that Nephi omitted mention of the triumphant encounter with the Nims on his small plates, but would or might have reported it on the large plates, does not support the other's hypothesis, but further undermines it. For if the large plates were indeed the place for giving more details about political and military events, Nephi would have recorded there the encounter and merger with the Nims, and the victories in wars they helped him win. The large plates, we are told, were handed down to King Mosiah, and through him and successors, eventually to Mormon himself. In order to make his abridgment down to King Benjamin, Mormon would have read Nephi's political account, as presumably would all successive Nephite keepers of the record. Yet there is no indication that any subsequent writer or speaker in the Book of Mormon knows anything about the actual events that made possible the founding of Nephite society and the reign of the first Nephite king. As we will see, the Nephites throughout the book are thus in the same strange position as the Nim-infused group that became known as the Lamanites. Though they know in detail about the family feud between Nephi and his brothers and how the families came out of Jerusalem, they are completely ignorant of the subsequent events in which two alien cultures collided and two small family groups came to dominate. Thus, what Richard Bushman has called a group's founding saga survives only as the story of the immigrant families. Because the Nims and their descendants would so greatly outnumber the Israelites and theirs on both sides of the Lehite Divide, this information deficit means that, in terms of their actual lineage and ancestral origins, neither the Nephites or Lamanites actually know who they are. Perhaps readers of the book, for its first 150 years, can be excused for not understanding either. In sum, given the many reasons for Nephi to have reported his meeting and conversion of the Nims, his failure to do so constitutes very strong, perhaps compelling evidence against the other's hypothesis. If the Book of Mormon is an account of Lamanite identity, is the Book of Mormon account of Lamanite identity and ideology consistent with the other's hypothesis? Another example of how the other's hypothesis creates new and difficult issues regarding the nature of the book and its historicity is found in the text's account of the Lamanites and their ideology. Turning to the early Lamanite side of the story, Laman and Lemuel's competitive group had to have jumped with equal alacrity from family into society. Their group, in tandem with Nephi's, also had to have encountered and dominated a considerably larger group of Nims. It is reasonable to infer that the influx of Nims on the Lamanite side would have equaled or exceeded that on the Nephite side. That augmentation must be roughly equal in size because Nephi reports warfare between the groups and neither side overwhelmed the other. Without support of their own Nims, the small number of adult able-bodied males on the Lamanite side would have posed no threat to the metalworking, sword-manufacturing society of farmers and builders Nephi describes. They would have been able to mount perhaps one small suicidal attack. Further, if there were any significant disparity in numbers between the two groups of encountered and assimilated Nims, the Lamanite influx would have been larger because, about 150 years later, Jerem reports that the Lamanites were exceedingly more numerous than the Nephites. Further, the pattern of Lamanite numerical superiority continues throughout the book. Under the prior stage 1 and 2 understandings of the book, Lamanite identity was rather simple and straightforward, at least until the temporary merging of the two groups following the appearance of the risen Messiah. All Lamanites were seen as the descendants of the original small group and stayed with Laman and Lemuel when the immigrant group split. That understanding of Lamanite identity is not surprising because, as Brent Lee Metcalf has recently pointed out, every time anyone in the book speaks of lineage or heritage, whether as Nephite or Lamanite, he reports being descended from an Israelite or identifies his ancestors as having migrated from Jerusalem. On the Lamanite side, this consistent self-reporting is always linked to the same founding story and family feuding that Nephi and the other Nephite recorders describe in more detail. According to Lamanite King Amaron, he is a descendant of Zoram, who was, quote, pressed and brought out of Jerusalem, end quote, by the Nephite founders. Similarly, King Lamoni's father threatens his son for associating with Ammon, a Nephite, who is one of the children of a liar who robbed our fathers.
Both kings function as confirming examples of the same ideology being instilled in Lamanite children for generations before them. Four centuries after arrival, the Lamanites are reported diligently teaching their children about all the wrongs Nephi inflicted upon Laman and Lemuel, first in Jerusalem, next in the wilderness, then upon the seas, and finally in the land of their first inheritance, which occurs at Mosiah 10:12-17. When Ammon preaches to Lamoni, a descendant of Ishmael, and Lamanite king over that land, he tells him and his servants the Nephite version of the same founding story. This includes a rehearsal of, quote, the rebellions of Laman and Lemuel and the sons of Ishmael, close quote, in connection with Ammon's expounding of all, quote, all the records and scriptures from the time that Lehi left Jerusalem down to the present time. Nephite records and understanding are thus portrayed as the mirror image of those expressed and implied in Lamanite ideology. In sum, the Lamanite founding story and dominant ideology clearly reflect knowledge of their Israelite origin, their common ancestry with the Nephites because of that origin, and an ideology of hatred based upon mistreatment of Laman and Lemuel by Nephi. Like the Nephites, however, they are unaware of any founding or other subsequent event in which their ancestors encountered and mixed with any others. Like their Nephite counterparts, the descendants of Laman's numerically superior Nims are equally ignorant of their ancestral origin and lineage. By the time Jacob writes, the cultural dominance of Laman's group of Israelites over their own Nims is implied to be complete as that achieved by Nephi's group. Jacob thus reports that just as the subgroups or clans of Nephites are referred to individually as Nephites, Jacobites, Josephites, and Zoramites, so the Lamanite subgroups were called by the names of the founding Israelite families, Lamanites, Lemuelites, and Ishmaelites. Once adopted, these initial subgroup or clan names persist without change for nearly 1,000 years. Given their persistence and function in the story, in my view, it is difficult to understand or characterize these classifications as some sort of mere ethnocentric labeling convention imposed by stage four Nephite record keepers upon a more complex, polynemic ethnic world. These were not mere labels. The Zoramites are major players in the story. Zoram functions as a pressed ancestor. The land of Ishmael is named after Ishmael or his sons, and throughout the book, descent is always traced to one of the same Israelite founders. The ethnic nomenclature and groupings first reported by Jacob are so sturdy that after 800 years later, after 200 years in which there were no separate ethnic groups, no ites, the people who were once one in spirit and purpose begin to separate and call themselves by the names of the original Israelite founders again. The newly revived Lamanites on cue begin to refer to their opponents by the names of the original founders again as Jacobites, Josephites, and Zoramites. The Nims encountered by Laman's group, also vastly superior in numbers, would, like Nephi's Nims, also have had a completely different alien language, culture, and religion. As on the Nephite side of things, Laman and Lemuel would have had to find some way to overcome these differences in order to achieve dominance and control. In his discussion of the puzzle of Lamanite ideology, Richard Bushman notes that Laman and Lemuel had little to commend them as effective, persuasive leaders. He observes that, based upon the text, all that the brothers understood was violence. He remarks, force was their characteristic reaction to crisis, the only language they understood in such situations. Plunging deeper, he observes, the Freudians would say that Laman and Lemuel had archaic superegos. That is, the internal monitors that controlled their egos used terror rather than persuasion. Nevertheless, at the event level, the other's hypothesis commends to Book of Mormon readers. These same brothers managed somehow to overcome their archaic penchant for violence and terror in order to persuade the leaders of the Nims they encountered to join with them in founding a new society. The point is not that the similar success of Laman and Lemuel with the indigenous Nims mirroring Nephi's is utterly impossible. The success of both groups of Lehites, however, in one generation and against the vast numeric odds is certainly remarkable. The more telling point is that nothing in the text reveals a knowledge by anyone of this dual success story that made possible the founding of Nephite and Lamanite society. Finally, though they cannot be treated in detail here, the text's account of Lamanite ideology and religion and the nature of dissent among the Nephites, when considered under the others hypothesis, presents other serious difficulties. If apart from the Book of Ether, the book is read as a story only of the founding Lehites and Mulekite immigrants and their descendants, the lack of any ideological competition from any indigenous religion infecting the Lamanites and Nephite dissenters is completely understandable, for no such competing indigenous religion exists. With the required influx of Nims with an alien culture and religion at the outside of the story, together with the use of indigenous others to address population problems later in the book, however, the absence of reference to such religious competition is difficult to explain. In sum, I believe the book's account of Lamanite identity and ideology, as well as its descriptions of the nature of Nephite dissenters, like Nephi's silence, or as we will see, reticence about the Nims, is further evidence that it was not written from a stage 4 situation or perspective. Rather, the book reflects instead a situation in which all actors in the text outside of the Book of Ether are described as and are understood by everyone who speaks in the text to be descendants of the Israelite immigrants who came from Jerusalem. Is the Book of Mormon's account of skin color differences compatible with the others' hypothesis? If approximately 30 Israelites on each side of the divided Lehite family merged with much larger groups of Amerindians, what are the consequences for the book's account of skin color? The Book of Mormon has traditionally been understood to tell the story of two competing and warring groups, which, at least until they merged at the time of 3rd Nephi, could be characterized as lighter-skinned and darker-skinned. A variation of the traditional reading is that adopted by some readers of the book who explain the, quote, skin of blackness reference in 2nd Nephi in a natural, biological manner. That is, a change in skin pigment among the early Lamanites actually did occur, but it was the natural result of intermarriage between the Israelites of Laman's group with native Amerindian people. If the foregoing analysis is correct, then by the 20-year mark of the New World story, only a small fraction of either the Nephite or Lamanite group would actually have consisted of persons who were of Israelite descent. The remainder would have been the indigenous predecessors of the Maya. Moreover, within a few generations through intermarriage, the lighter skins of the relatively few Israelites, together with all their phenotype characteristics, would have disappeared. Accordingly, from the beginning of Nephi's composition of the record, the story of two competing groups, one lighter-skinned, the other darker-skinned, would have been counterfactual, fictional. Neither the traditional reading of a skin color change among the Lamanites resulting from a divine curse, or the more recent natural interpretation in which a change only in Lamanite skin color occurred through intermarriage with native Amerindians, is consistent with the Mesoamerican others hypothesis. Most all LDS commentators on the book, down to the present day, continue to write as if there was an actual difference in skin color between the two groups. Recent examples include not only Rodney Turner, but Richard Bushman and John Tvednes. An alternative approach taken by some LDS interpreters of the book is that the skin curse it describes was, from the very beginning, only metaphorical. Hugh Nibley appears to take this view. That is, when Nephi and later Jacob invoke darkened skin color among the Lamanites, they are really using it only as a metaphor for moral filthiness or unrighteousness, and are not speaking literally about skin pigment. This more politically correct reading is in tension with Nephi's language about a skin of blackness and later language in Alma where, as Richard Bushman notes, the curse is again explained as a visual mark. Nevertheless, under the others' hypothesis, the text's description of darker skin as a visual marker is not the principal problem with the metaphorical interpretation. Again, Nephi reports that he began inscribing his small plates after the 20-year mark. So by the time he began writing his record, he knew that the vast majority of his own group was comprised of Nims and their children. That would be true even without intermarriage. Nor is there any indication in the text that there was any restriction on intermarriage between Nephi's Israelites and the Nims. Jacob's condemnation of polygamy clearly suggests the opposite. So by the time he was writing, intermarriage between Nephi's small number of Israelites and the Nims would already have been occurring. On the Lamanite side, Nephi would also have known about the merger of Laman's small group with a numerically superior group of Nims, because he reports that by the 30-year mark, there were there had been wars and contentions with the group. So why would different skin color have come to mind at all as a way of articulating a divine curse, or indeed of distinguishing between his people and Laman's group at all? Why, in light of that knowledge, would he also describe the latter-day European immigrants he witnessed in vision as, quote, white and exceedingly fair and beautiful, like unto my people before they were slain? If we move forward to Jacob's discourse at the temple, we find the same emphasis on a darker skin color being associated with moral filthiness. Jacob tells his followers, his listeners, behold, Lamanites, your brethren, whom ye hate because of their filthiness and the cursing which hath come upon their skins, are more righteous than you. Next verse, O my brethren, I fear that unless ye shall repent of your sins, that their skins will be whiter than yours when ye shall be brought with them before the throne of God. Wherefore, a commandment I give unto you, which is the word of God, that ye revile no more against them because of the darkness of their skins. Neither shall ye revile against them because of their filthiness, but ye shall remember your own filthiness and remember that their filthiness came about because of their fathers. Why would it have occurred to Jacob to preach to his nim-filled audience about skin color as the sign of a divine curse, when his own skin color would have been lighter than theirs, and their skin color would, in all likelihood, have been indistinguishable from the nims of Laman's group? Further, why would Jacob's nims ever have been involved in reviling against the nims now called Lamanites, whom they had seen and met in battle, based upon their darker skin color? At a more fundamental level, the problem with the use of darker skin color, even as a metaphorical indicator of moral filthiness, is that it would be the opposite of what Nephi and Jacob would have emphasized to the nims about skin color differences from the very beginning. Nephi's leadership and preaching task from the outset of the encounter with the nims and Jacob's after him clearly would have been to ignore or downplay rather than emphasize skin color and any other irrelevant differences in physical appearance between the Israelite immigrants and the nims they were trying to teach, convert, and assimilate. In sum, under the Mesoamerican Others hypothesis, the book's repeated focus on and discourse about darkened differential skin color as a distinction between the Nephite and Lamanite groups, whether considered as a reported historical reality or merely as metaphorical religious discourse, is, it appears to me, completely inexplicable. Whether that critical conclusion is accepted or not, it is worth considering whether, if it adopts the Mesoamerican Others hypothesis, the Church will nevertheless continue teaching, in its curriculum materials and otherwise, that the Book of Mormon relates a history in which the Lamanites are a group, as a group, were darker skinned than the Nephites. As noted, the physical appearance of most all Nephites from the time Nephi began his record had to have been Amerindian. If that analysis is correct, how long will the Church continue teaching the traditional pictorial and narrative story? Consider these illustrations from the Church's current website. These are from the Book of Mormon stories for children. So this is telling the story of 2 Nephi 5 pictorially. It starts out saying, the Lord told Nephi to lead the righteous people into the wilderness. They traveled for many days and finally stopped at a land they named Nephi. The people who followed Nephi obeyed God. They worked hard and were blessed. Nephi taught his people to build with wood and metal. They built a beautiful temple. And then switching to the Lamanite side, Laman and Lemuel's followers called themselves Lamanites. They became a dark-skinned people. God cursed them because of their wickedness. Next. The Lamanites became lazy and would not work. I include two pictures of Samuel the Lamanite to further illustrate the differential skin color that's presented pictorially. Samuel, a Lamanite prophet, went to Zarahemla to preach to the wicked Nephites. He told them to repent. The Nephites threw Samuel out of the city, and he started going back to his own land. Okay, clearly the story that is still being told, it was the story that I understood, and I think the story that scholars continue to write and describe about the Book of Mormon is that there were these two groups with having a different skin color, Nephites lighter skinned and Lamanites with darker skin. There's one more slide. This is the triumph of Captain Moroni. Will change.
As you know, for example, the picture of Moroni burying the plates that we see so often, he indeed looks fairly Anglo, as does Mormon in this picture. However, under the other hypothesis, my contention is, for generations before them, their physical appearance, the physical appearance of all the Nephite prophets for many generations before Moroni and Mormon would have been Amerindian, specifically would have been Mayan. And at some point, perhaps, that will become reflected as people think through the implications of the other's hypothesis. Something like that might be reflected so that Mormon, as a young man, might look more like this, which is a picture of a modern-day pure and delightsome Mayan youth. Okay. Brent has asked that I reserve time for questions, and one of the remaining sections deals with the explanations that have been offered by apologists for why Nephi and others don't mention the others more expressly. And I'll have to, deferring, I think, to the desire for questions, I'll have to defer that to the written paper and not present that with you here. Thanks very much for your attention.
Thanks very much, David. What we would like to do is, for those who have questions, if you wouldn't mind coming up to the mic so that we can hear the questions. And if you have comments to make, please keep them brief and ensure that they lead to a question. Otherwise, you're free to come up and speak with David after the session if you'd like to. So if anybody has a question, please come on up. Yes.
I've thought if Moroni was so lonely after his people had been destroyed, did that mean all of the Amerinds in the Americas, were they associated with the Lamanites at that point? Any thoughts on that? Does that seem like an issue or a problem?
Let me respond this way. Actually, part of the fascination of the movement from stage to stage is the increasing ambiguity of who the modern-day remnant of the House of Israel is. At stage one, it's all by descent. They are the only people there, and so it's very clear that the Lamanites are modern-day Lamanites, are seen as simply the descendants of Lehi. That's the way that what Nephi sees in vision is that his seed becomes mixed with his brother's seed, and they survive in order to be the recipients of the plates along with the Gentiles, and in the modern era. Now, what has happened because of that ambiguity that now arises is that people have been trying to figure out, among other things, trying to figure out how to restore the kind of simplicity that existed at stage one. And one effort to do this, for example, is in Trent Stevens and Jeffrey Meldrum's article in the Journal of Book of Mormon Studies. And their way to solve the problem is to make everything simple again by saying, at the death of Moroni, everyone in both hemispheres of the Americas became a member of the House of Israel. So that in the future, when Joseph Smith was writing and when the book came out, this means that everybody throughout the Americas, even though they had no lineage relationship with the people inside the text, they should be thought of, Stevens and Meldrum suggest, as members of the House of Israel. That, I think, it doesn't have any support in the text, but it does, and I think is driven by a desire to make things as simple as they were back at stage one, even after we acknowledge that we have moved to stage four. So I see it as creating, solving the problem by revisionist fiat, which is announcing that everybody will be should be understood as members of the House of Israel. That would include the Inuit, for example, who would have no connection at all with no reason to believe that they would have any connection at any time with Book of Mormon peoples.
Just to note, too, we already have two people up here for questions. If you want to come in and sit up at the front and kind of wait your turn, you're welcome to do that at any point. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks for your presentation. My question has to do with theories of, I guess I could call it presentism, that I've heard recently in terms of reading the book, that go beyond, for example, Sorensen's notion that the Mayans were not really inferred in the text but actually suppressed somehow. And I think, for example, of the idea, I don't know where I heard this, but that the Mulekites were somehow not, that they were lying about their lineage, that they were, and perhaps for political purposes or something. And of course, the text doesn't say that. And so the second question I have is, because it doesn't say that, obviously, why does it bother you that there are these presentist theories? And I know why it bothers me, but I'm interested to hear why it bothers you. So.
I discuss, unfortunately, I discuss in part of the paper that I couldn't read because of time, explanations by Sorensen and others about why it is that there was not more express mention of the individuals, and I don't the inferred Mayans. The closest anyone comes, and I say this honestly, perhaps it's based upon what I've read, and I haven't been able to find anything better. The closest anyone comes to explaining or attempting an explanation of this is Matthew Roper in his Nephi's Neighbors article, and what he suggests. First, he attributes the origin of failing to distinguish between converts and descendants of the Israelites and others, he attributes it to Jacob, when actually, of course, it's Nephi that starts the silence going or the reticence going. And then the only explanation he offers for why that would have occurred is that it would have been foundational to the cohesion of Nephite society. So he, in one sentence, he suggests that the reason that silence occurred and the Nims are not recognized or referred to is that it was somehow necessary to preserve the unity of Nephite society. My own view is that I don't know why a celebration of the miraculous conversion of a large populace as the part of the founding story wouldn't have served as object lesson and as a wonderful founding story, and it would have, as the saying goes, the added benefit of being true.
This is kind of a little bit broader than just your subject. I'd be interested to hear what Brent's response to this would be also. Do you ever see a time when the majority of religious people will kind of see through some of these ridiculous attempts by some apologists to conform either to political correctness or to prove their position? I mean, you see a lot of it. You see, you know, this attempt to separate the Book of Mormon from racism, or, you see creationists trying to do with evolution. You see idiots like Josh McDowell trying to prove their resurrection. Do you ever see people, they'll finally see through the ridiculousness of these arguments and finally, I don't know what their response would be, but do you ever see a day when that'll happen?
I'd want to say that the arguments on this topic, anyway, from apologists are vary in their quality. Okay, I don't want to say that there are no reasonable apologetic positions with respect to the movement in the Book of Mormon from stage one through stage four. It is fascinating, though, to me, and I think this what I've been describing today is it has occurred because there is a new constituency of people reading the book, people whose sensibilities are informed by science, who know about, for example, evolution. And so what everyone is in the process of doing, just say Christians, for example, is sorting out their own relationship to the story of the Garden of Eden in light of what science tells us about when and how human beings emerged. And I think the same process is going on here in the Book of Mormon, that Book of Mormon is colliding not just with science, but with a readership who are informed by those ideas. And so that's why the struggle takes and the dialogue takes the shape that it does.
As luck would have it, I think it's 3:15, and so time to end things. I'll just make one quick comment, and that is that what you kind of see going on in the church right now. If any of you have been out to the Farm's website over the last few days, there's a statement by Nolby Reynolds, who's the director of Farm's, up on their website. You have to go through the statement to get into the website now, and it's responding to the AP article that Patty Hennitz wrote a few weeks back on Simon Southerton's forthcoming book on DNA and the Book of Mormon. And it was really interesting to me because in that response, what he's trying to reiterate is that we are not trying to write, we as in Farms, not trying to write church doctrine or craft church doctrine. Rather, we're expressing our opinions and trying to give insight to other people. And then I reflect back on, you know, John Sorensen's paper that he wrote for the Enzyme magazine back in 1984, in which was called Digging into the Book of Mormon. I have the draft of that paper. And there was a statement in there that it was an interesting opinion. Let's put it this way. That ended up being deleted from the published version. And that was the statement that either the Book of Mormon Promised Land was in some portion of Mesoamerica or it was nowhere. That's his opinion. Okay? And to me, that's about as strong as you can get to making a pronouncement of fact. And yet that is his position. But now, because of this eventual collision that you see coming at each other, right, you've got general authorities right up to the present who are, you know, giving dedicatory prayers at temples and so on, talking about the people in Latin America and in South America being the seed of Nephi, the children of Lehi, and so on and so forth. They're coming head to head. And it's you know, these are two trains that are going right at each other. The question is anybody going to step forward and pull the switch on the track so they don't collide? Who knows? Anyway, thank you.